bring to order the Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd, and we have several items on our agenda. We're going to first adopt rules for the Subcommittee. We'll have a brief introduction of ourselves, and then we're going to have a public hearing and possible work session on a couple of bills. With that, I will open an organizational meeting. And the first order of business is adoption of the committee rules. Teresa, would you, if you'd hold on just for a second. Sure.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, subcommittee members. The rules that are in front of you are identical to the rules that you have seen throughout your policy committee first meetings yesterday. So they are identical. I should point out that for the audience in particular, that the subcommittee cannot do committee bill introductions. That is done with through the full Business and Labor Committee, and also cannot pass bills to the floor. So the process is that the bills are vetted here, then go to the full, and then from there, if they go ahead, then they'll head to the floor after that.
Thank you very much. Questions or discussion on the rules that are before us? Vice Chair Huffman.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the committee rules.
Vice Chair Huffman has moved adoption of the committee rules. Discussion on that motion? Hearing none? Seeing none? Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, they are adopted. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Introduction of committee members. Representative Kenemer, would you like to begin that process?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Kenemer, state rep from the Orion City Canby area, District 39.
Michael Dembrough, and I represent Northeast Portland, Park Rose, and the city of Maywood Park.
I'm Paul Holby, District 8, South Eugene, Crow, Applegate, Lorain, Notai, and Vinita.
John Huffman, District 59, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, Grant, Jefferson, parts of Deschutes, Clackamas, and Marion counties.
Brad Witt, House District 31, and I represent the extreme northwest corner of our state.
Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford.
I'm Mitch Greenock, I represent House District 33, which is northwest Portland and the unincorporated suburbs of Multnomah and Washington County out to North Plains from the river.
Thank you.
Right next to Brad. I'm Brad's neighbor.
There we go. Yes. Thank you very much, subcommittee members. I'm going to close the organizational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 3651. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3651 subjects public works projects that involve the construction or installation of a solar energy system to prevailing wage rate law. The measure establishes an operative date of January 1st, 2011, and there is an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage.
Thank you very much. I am going to call up, first of all, let's see what we have here. I'm going to call up Joe Esmond and Bob Shiprack, please.
Go ahead, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack. I'm Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. Seems like a couple days ago we were testifying in front of this committee on this bill, so I'll reiterate the points that I made at that time. This bill is coming to you in order to bring clarity to an issue regarding the implementation of prevailing wages for solar projects on public facilities or public buildings, land, etc. Clarity in that there was a Bureau of Labor and Industries wage determination on a project on a facility owned by Multnomah County where they said that the prevailing wages would not apply despite the fact that there was a contract, there was money involved, It's on a public facility. I'm not here to argue one way or the other what fully interpreted, because the determination order is very short. That did, however, create a situation where other governments were wondering whether or not their project would apply prevailing wages or not, and some voluntarily instituted and others didn't. In order to avoid litigation, which could go on for some time, and with this session coming up, the parties involved agreed to come to the legislature to clarify when prevailing wages would apply to these projects. This is, I want to emphasize, a very narrow bill. There's probably not going to be a lot of these projects. As I mentioned to the committee last time, there's some question, and you folks will be dealing with the business energy tax credit. Oftentimes, that tax credit was used on these projects. There's some discussion that perhaps that will not be used on public facilities such as what we're describing here. So it really narrows down the number of projects that we're talking about. But nonetheless, it is important that we know what the rules are going to be. What further complicates this issue is there's a variety of methods that developers have used on this. Sometimes the solar installation ultimately is turned over to the public agency. They own it. They've paid for it through the electricity sales, for instance. There are oftentimes are binding contracts that lay this out. So it's kind of an area where there's no guidelines. So in order to clarify, the bill simply says if you're going to put solar installations on public land or buildings, you pay the prevailing wage, period. I hope that I've adequately described what the intent is. There'll be other folks perhaps going more into the technical aspects, but that's what we're trying to accomplish here today, and hope you'll find a favorable response. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks very much. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I'm a business agent for the IBW Local 48 based in Portland, Oregon. I want to echo what Bob said, much better spoken than I, and has a longer history of prevailing wage. I just want to emphasize that we have been working with the Bureau of Labor and Industries for the past few months to work this out. My own view is the financial systems and ways of all that got ahead of the law, and it sowed confusion. And we feel, and I'm not an attorney, since they are getting the tax credits, the overarching policy that it should be prevailing wage. I'll be happy to answer any questions, but not way down in the weeds.
All right. Thank you both very, very much. Questions for our panel members from the subcommittee. Vice Chair Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably for Bob. Does this matter if there are tax credits involved or not? Tax credits are not a part of this bill, is that correct?
That's
it's strictly public ownership?
That's correct, okay. Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the representative pointing that out. The only reason I brought up the tax credit issue is that a number of these projects have been funded through them. They are not they're not subject to public monies. Actually, the monies that I'm talking about are the funds that the public agency actually expends for the solar installation through the purchase of the electricity and things like that. They essentially pay that off, and that's clearly money that comes from the, in my opinion, from the public. So, in effect, you have the public has, as one person described to me, the public is paying twice for these, once through the tax credit and once through the payoff of the facility itself. I hope that clarifies that. But I'm not suggesting just because of the tax credit that it would be prevailed.
Maybe follow up. Please. This is probably more than a comment than a question, but if you want to respond to it, it's fine. I think I'd be maybe a little closer to support if it did have some of that criteria in there, that it was definitely publicly owned, and it does say that. Use of the Betsy, for example. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would have to think it through if I have another point. The February session for me, I came in here with the sole intent to support job creation. And I'm just concerned at this point in our recession, even though you're probably right, there are very few projects that this would affect. I don't want to do anything this session that's going to maybe create an impediment to job creation, construction, whatever. And even though it may be small, I can kind of see the potential for that impediment. So I've got a concern.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I can get past it or not.
The only response I would have to that, Mr. Chair and Representative Huffman, is, again, because of the confusion, a lot of the public agencies are simply on their own saying, we think this should be prevailed. So you may, in fact, hear some testimony to that effect. So that's what we're trying to get at. It's not an impediment. It's what is the right thing to do here. That's what we're trying to clarify.
I have Representative Esquivel up next with Representative Kenemer on deck.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, tell me that I have a building that is owned by the government, and I lease it for a triple net for 10 years. But I'm a private entity. Why would this come into play when I have a contractual agreement with the government to have a triple net where I take care of anything on that building, taxes, maintenance, anything?
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty uncomfortable with this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, you own the building?
No. The government owns the building. I'm leasing it.
You're leasing.
And I'm in a contractual agreement with a lease. And it's a triple net lease. I take care of everything. Why would it be my responsibility to pay a prevailing wage when I decided I would like to have solar energy in a facility that I have leased and I'm paying for?
I'd have to look. I'm not trying to dodge this at all, but I'd have to look at the language, and this is a whole different.
Well, that's the way I think, though.
And I'm
sorry, Bob. and you know my position on prevailing wage. You and I have gone together in the lion's den on it.
I understand that. I think ultimately the fact that it is owned by the government, and then you could ultimately break the lease or get out of it, or you know you're done with it, would tend to say that it would probably, under the bill, would probably prevail. But I'd like to check that.
The chair would be interested to know, and maybe someone here does. I certainly don't. How often that scenario?
I do know that we do lease to private entities down south,
okay,
and their government buildings.
Huh.
But having said that, that's the only thing. And I'm a realtor. That's the first thing that came to my mind. So I'm sorry that I'm thinking like a realtor at this point, because and I know it's a bad habit. But
I think like a legislator.
That's even worse, isn't it?
That's scary.
Teresa, would you look into that
for us
and just find out how common that is?
Some information on that, because to me that's a stickler. Because I have a contractual agreement with the government, but I take care of everything on this thing. And once you have a lease and it's a 10-year or 20-year, that property belongs to me for that period of time, as long as I maintain, pay the taxes, upkeep on the building, pay everything in the building, and that property is mine to do with anything that I want to do with it, just like a rental. So I have certain rights.
That's a new one.
Yep, you pay taxes on the building.
All right. That may be an issue at some other levels of government. I'm just not aware of it being very common at the state level. But let's, if we could get some further clarification on that, it might be helpful. Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some along the lines of Sal's question, I guess. You know, part of it is, Bob, you've talked about this pretty narrow bill, and that seems to be my impression. I guess the criticism that I've heard is that it sets a really dangerous precedent, and I'm having trouble seeing that, and I wondered about your perspective. You know, that pretty soon on private projects and you know, because a lot of them, something along lines, Sal's speaking, as well as, you know, when people are trading these credits, the tax credits and stuff, it gets pretty complicated and is often done as a private sector rather than as a public sector event.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, you raise a good point, but that is why we were very, very specific in the bill to point out that these are publicly owned land or buildings that they're putting these on. I don't want to ever get into, you know, there's got to be some public investment in this stuff. There's got to be some ownership. There's got to be the fact that you've got a school roof that's owned by the, obviously it's a school district property. So I don't know if I'm even answering your question, but I really wasn't trying to go there at all with this. I just want to fix a very narrow problem that's come up. It's got some confusion out there, and hopefully the legislature can clarify this.
Thank you. I have Representative Holvey with Vice Chair Huffman on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have a couple of questions, but I also wanted to, you know, comment on Representative Esquivel's comment about, you know, why would we have to pay prevailing wage if we leased it and I'm paying everything for the lease. I think historically, you know, the government owns the building, and at the end of that lease, the government is retaining the value of the investment that was put in there, and it could be a way to get around prevailing wage to just lease it out and have something built and not pay anything, and then the lease is over and the government just remodeled their whole building without paying prevailing wage. But I think ultimately the owner of the building is the government, and even if you lease it, generally you can't do major renovations and remodeling to the building without the owner's permission to do that. And the owner does intrinsically keep the value of that, I guess, enhancement to the building. So it is a public fund at that point, I believe. So I think that's part of the how I see the reasoning. The other question I have, I guess, is a little more into the weeds for Bob. You know, I do support this piece of legislation. I fundamentally agree with you that in this case there are public funds in use. But I guess my question is that you're exempting essentially solar projects from a certain part of the law that deals with tax credits are not public funds, and the $750,000 use of public funds on a private project. And so this particular bill is an exemption to those requirements. And I guess my question is, we just passed those requirements, I believe, in 2007 in a bill, and it seems to me that if we're talking about prevailing wage, and we're fundamentally, like the federal government considers, if you use public funds, then you pay Davis-Bacon. There is no other who owns it or any other sort of criteria. And it seems to me, I go off on the other side of this thing to say that, you know, I think Oregon could clear up a lot of confusion about what is and what is not subject to prevailing wage rate if we developed a clear standard that says if you use public funds of more than, I think before the $750,000, we had a $50,000 trigger, if you use more than $50,000 of public funds, it needs to pay prevailing wage. And in fact, a tax credit is a diversion of your of state tax revenue into the private sector. So I have two pieces to this that I think ought to happen, and that is that we ought to do away with the idea that tax credits are not public funds, one. And the second part is that we need to revisit that use of $750,000 of public funds and not triggering prevailing wage. It's clearly not consistent with federal Davis-Bacon law, and it is, to me, just a morass of confusion about how to implement prevailing wage law, which is an important use to set standards for living wage jobs when we use public monies. And that is the policy. When we use public monies, we should be paying a living wage, and we establish that through the prevailing wage surveys and determinations. And if I had my druthers, that's how I would fix this bill. Mm-hmm. I would, because I don't see any difference between a solar project and some other sort of project that uses public funds and a tax credit. We should, if we're going to exempt one, I recognize Representative Kinnemer's, this is a precedent, I suppose, but I think a bigger precedent was set when we said, we can use $750,000 of public monies and not pay prevailing wage. And we can use, and tax credits are not public funds. My point is that what we should do is change those two pieces, and then there wouldn't be a problem with this at all. So,
would it be fair?
I don't know that was a question. But I guess my question is exactly this, is that you're taking this small tax credit scenario that does use some public funds, and you're exempting them from those two requirements, that a tax credit is not a public fund, and you're exempting it from the $750,000 requirement. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, tax credits, to my knowledge, as long as I've been involved in this issue, have never been described as public funds. They should be, however. The problem that I see is that the government, bless them, come up with new funding schemes all the time, and it's hard for us to keep track of it. My testimony last time I was here was back in 2007. The Betsy program was $3 million. We didn't even know what it was. The federal government then came up with the new market tax credits, for instance, about the same time. Next full legislative session, we are going to tackle the very issue that Representative Holvey asked. What are public funds? Because it is unclear. It should be straightened out. Clearly, tax credits come right out of the general fund of this state. It's tax money, just as if you wrote a check. So I cannot disagree with you. It needs to be changed. I didn't think we could do it in the February session, however. So I just want to try and tackle this very narrow issue that we've got here and thoroughly examine the whole area of what our public funds, and you're absolutely, I cannot disagree.
Well, I guess I'll support your bill, stand down, and look forward to working with you on in the future.
I appreciate it.
Stay tuned for 2011.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Bob, let's say the government owns the building.
Yes.
It has a huge flat roof. Mm-hmm. And Invenergy or Iberdrola or somebody that does large PV projects comes along and they want to privately own the project and lease the rooftop, so give an annual stipend to the state for the lease of the rooftop, but the PV project is privately owned. Where would that project fit in this? Because some of the examples you were describing would be where essentially the state would own the solar project. But what if it's that lease situation, like on a wind farm where you lease the patch of dirt from the farmer, but Vestas owns the wind tower?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huffman, the examples that I'm aware of, and again, because this is fairly new and there's not a lot of these, the ones I'm familiar with are a situation where a private developer puts the installation on a roof of a government building or on the land that the public owns through various schemes, how it's paid for. There's a lot of various ways, tax credits, whatever. But at the end of the day, after 10 or 20 years, for instance, what I'm told is they turn the equipment then becomes owned by the school district,
right,
or whatever. The other thing that is troubling, though, is, and this is where the public pays twice on these, is that they're also purchasing the electricity and, in effect, paying off that installation through their payments as well. So the lease thing, I'm just not aware where it stays private. It's not a private. It's a maybe public-private enterprise, or at the end of the day, a public enterprise altogether. So I hope I'm trying to answer your question as best as I can, but that's my experience in this very narrow area.
In under your scenario, I can see that. I guess talking to Invenergy and some of the companies that want to put in 80 and 100 acre solar farms, or
right,
you know, kind of like the wind farms, and I wasn't thinking in terms of the public entity buying back the electricity,
sure,
like you stated, because a lot of times they'll contract with Wasco Rural Electric to be a part of their 25-25 portfolio or something like that. So I was thinking about maybe this private contractor would actually be contracting with maybe California to sell the electricity down there. The government-owned rooftop would simply be the vehicle, and they would get an annual lease payment for the use of the roof.
Mr. Chair, actually, a lot of the governments, you know, the green stuff, where, well, our roof is supplying green energy, and that's what's making the lights run, you know. They don't understand how electricity works, but, you know, they can say it's coming from our rooftop. So they're purchasing it.
If I may,
please.
Representative Huffman, the models I've seen is the power is supplied at a fixed rate to the public entity. Quite frankly, if I was a city official and somebody came to me and said, we want to use your rooftops and we'll give you power at 8 cents a kilowatt, or, you know, with a small inflator for 20 years and you get to go with it, what do I sign? I mean, I don't fault the public officials, really. The financial schemes is a bad word. New ways of doing business have gotten ahead of the intent, in my view, the intent of the law. And that's what we're trying to fix. We had one project in Portland where they added the prevailing wage language into the contract, and it's worked fine. It's up and going. So we're not trying to stop business. I got Representative Escobar, I got thousands of people in the IBW out of work. So we just want to help fix the law. And again, I want to reiterate, we've worked very, very closely with the Bureau of Labor, and you'll be hearing more shortly.
Representative Dumbrough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm you know, attracted to the principles behind this bill, and, you know, I share Representative Holthe's sentiment that this is part of a larger issue that I think we really need to address, and I look forward to that. One of the attractions of having such a narrow bill, though, is that it gives us it takes us one piece and gives it some certainty, right? If I heard you correctly, Bob, that's essentially what you were saying, was that at present there's some uncertainty about these projects. And maybe, you know, I know that often uncertainty is what keeps projects from going forward. This would provide some certainty and perhaps would then facilitate in the short run some projects going forward, which we all want. We all want that work to be created. Is that a fair assessment of the situation? Do you see this bill as being conducive to projects or impediments to projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dumbro, as I mentioned, we've got public officials who are saying this should be prevailed. It's on our building. This is way, and again, the uncertain, the thing we want to avoid, this is the worst thing that can happen, drives me crazy, is you install something, there was no prevailing wage paid, then there's a wage claim filed, and this is what happens, it goes to Boeing and go, whoa, yeah. Because of the various financing mechanisms, they're a little bit different, and you could get a wage determination, and then you have to pay back wages for work that's already been done. I don't like that. It's maddening, and this is what's happened in the past, where we've come to the legislature attempting to clarify this so that there's no questions being raised about it. The fact that we have elected officials who have voluntarily said it should have been prevailed, or in fact we are going to prevail our building, tells me that this is not an issue where there's a big fight going on about whether or not this should be prevailing wage work or not. I hope that is helpful.
Thank you. If I could just Please. Follow up, actually this is on a different subject, and that when we had the hearing the last time, it seemed as if there was some, speaking of clarity, lack of clarity in the drafting of this bill. Was this the bill that we had that problem with, and is that going to be addressed?
Committee members, yes. The draft that was submitted that's in front of you actually did that. Yes, the fix was taken care of prior to it being a bill. So that issue is being
And everyone's
resolved.
Satisfied with the...
It's my understanding, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll be having Bowley up here in a little bit to testify as well. Additional questions or comments for our panel? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Thank
Certainly
you,
appreciate your time this morning. I'd like to call forward now, please, Kate Newhall. Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you here again this morning, now on House Bill 3651. And as some of you raised, we were here about, 2 or 3 weeks ago when it was LC 117 and had raised some technical issues with the bill. And I think all of those, we have worked with the proponents of the bill, and all of those, I think the technical issues that we had raised have been addressed in House Bill 3651, and it does now meet the intent of the proponents as we understand it. So we're here today to testify on House Bill 3651, which does apply prevailing wage law to certain and specific solar installation projects on public buildings and space. Typically, Oregon's prevailing wage law requires workers on public construction projects to be paid. Well, I'm going to skip that part. You guys all know this. But historically, projects have been covered by prevailing wage law if they meet two criteria, which we often refer to as the two-part test. And the first part of that test is that they qualify as a public works as defined by the law. And essentially that's that they are carried on or contracted for by a public agency. And two, that they utilize funds of a public agency, which is specifically defined, and you've had some conversations about that this morning. Not included in that definition of what is funds of a public agency are the tax credits and tax abatements. As we understand the nature of these projects right now, they are not installations that are carried on or contracted for by a public agency. And because they aren't, they don't meet the definition of public work for privately owned projects. And because they don't use any funds of a public agency, under current law, prevailing wage doesn't apply. What House Bill 3651 does, as you've talked about, is it creates a very narrow provision to apply prevailing wage to these very specific types of solar installation projects. And it does that by including these types of projects within the definition of a public work. So the typical kind of two-part test that I talked about would not apply in these instances. They would just be public works and would be covered by prevailing wage law. And I think I'm happy. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee might have. We are also happy to continue working with proponents and the committee as they consider and contemplate this bill and answer questions that you might have. Hopefully, I can answer them.
Thank you very much. One question that I have, Kate, is: do you have time? Can you stick around for the remainder of this hearing today?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that very much. In the event that questions may come up later on as testimony develops, other subcommittee members, anyone? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Kate, for your testimony. So, I just have a question: are there certainly the solar installations are a topic and something that's happened. Does the Bureau of Labor and Industry see other types of projects that fit into this type of category? For example, what if we had a similar situation with biomass or something else? They wouldn't be included in this particular bill, but are those sorts of arrangements happening with on public lands or public buildings?
You know, I couldn't really speak to that. The only, when we see these projects typically, and the project that's been discussed before from the from Multnomah County, we see them as they come to us as predeterminations for prevailing wage law. And to my knowledge, the only predetermination on any type of energy project has been on the solar installations. But as the bill is drafted right now, it would not apply to any wind power, biomass, wave energy, only the solar installation projects.
Thank you.
And we haven't been asked, like I said, to my knowledge, we haven't been asked for predeterminations on other types of projects.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. Hi, Kate. Do you guys support this bill? I'm not sure I heard what you said.
We do. The Bureau has taken a position of support on this bill. Oh,
thank you.
Representative
Esquivel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I was reading through this bill, and the one thing that stuck in my mind that's been in law for quite some time is it says a public corporation, but it doesn't really define that I can see, and maybe someone could help me here because I'm pretty abysmally ignorant when it comes to these issues. But a public corporation, couldn't that be interpreted as someone that sells public stock?
I guess where are you reading public corporation?
Page 2,
definition of
5. I mean, and that's the one thing that stuck out in my mind as I was going through this thing is, well, does that mean like a private? Well, I guess it wouldn't be private as long as they sell stock. But I mean, that isn't infringing upon the public sector, is it? I mean, the private sector.
And I would have to follow up with you on that. I don't believe that language is changing in any way how current law applies.
Well, I understand it, but I mean, that's what I saw. I picked up on it. It's been in existence for quite some time, but I mean, I looked at it and I'm thinking public corporation. I'm thinking of a bank, sell stock.
Teresa, could you get a legal read on that and
yes.
And perhaps email the
yeah.
subcommittee?
Yes, I'd
like a clarification
on that, please. Thank you. Additional questions or comments? That by the way, Representative Esquivel, I think is a good point. So thank you for bringing that up. Anyone else? Okay, I'm not seeing anything at this point. Thank you very much, Kate. Certainly appreciate it. Now, if I could please have John Killen and Robert Lane. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our subcommittee.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Please determine between yourselves who goes first.
I'll kick off here. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is John Killen. I'm the executive director of the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. Mr. Robert Lane is with us today. He's one of my members and a contractor very involved with these sorts of solar projects that we're talking about today. So he can answer some of the technical issues and has a few comments for you as well. I wanted to speak to the process I always enjoy following Mr. Shiprack because he does a great job of laying out the issue, and so I don't have to repeat a lot of that. The key thing here is that, as Ms. Newhall said, this is a departure from conventional law. We have a two-step criteria. It has to be contracted for and funds of a public agency. It's not an either-or. It's an and. And so this bill would create quite a departure and should not be taken lightly. That changes a lot of things. For instance, let me give you another example. You were talking about leasing property and whose property is it when it's all said and done. Something that's become common over the last couple of decades is cell towers being placed on public lands, school property, that sort of thing. Simple lease agreement. And it's out there. It's on school property. It's may even have some sort of contracts going back and forth. But yet, nobody would presume that to be a prevailing wage project because it's a simple lease agreement. And I think those sort of situations could arise in solar and whatnot. And this bill would interrupt some of those possibilities. And obviously, that's just an example of where that could be headed. Also wanted to point out, while there has been discussion by some groups on this subject for some time, there is actually a group called the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee with appointed folks from that the Labor Commissioner appoints to talk about these sorts of things and talk them out. The last time we talked about public-private partnerships, it was a pretty in-depth 18-month conversation to get to where we got, and a lot of compromise was had to get to that point. This subject hasn't been brought to that committee. Clearly, Bully's already taken a position without the advice of that committee, and that's their right to do so. But we would appreciate some conversation. As you've already discussed and found, there's a lot of questions on this subject, and it could go a whole different direction. It could a lot of things could happen with it, and so while I agree with Bob, we need some clarity. I feel like this bill might create less clarity moving forward, not more clarity, because it is such a departure from conventional law. With that, I'll let Mr. Robert Lane get into some of the details of, from his perspective, how these projects work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So I'm the owner of an electrical contracting company and a solar integrator, and we do work and bid on projects such as public agencies.
Excuse me, sir. Could you, just for the record, please introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Robert Lane.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So we do a lot of work on these and respond to RFPs that are initiated by public agencies. And I'm concerned that the extra expense that would accompany prevailing wage requirements would make the cost of energy so much higher that it may be unviable for an agency to consider. For example, last summer the Oregon Convention Center had an RFP out, and one of the respondents, not us, everybody else assumed it was not prevailing wage, but one respondent wasn't sure, and they said, here's our cost if it's not prevailing wage, and here's the cost of energy if it is. And it was about 3.2 cents per kilowatt higher. The average cost of energy is about 7 cents a kilowatt, so it's 40-ish percent higher cost of energy. So if a state agency or any public entity was considering that, and those were the rates, then their budget would go up, and they may not opt to do a project.
So, may I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Please, Representative Greenland.
Yeah, I'd like to, a little clarity on what you just said. The cost of electricity would be roughly twice as high in prevailing wage, and since I'm sure wages aren't 100% of the cost of doing the job, does that mean that the wage without prevailing wage is half of that you pay half prevailing wage when you don't have to pay prevailing wage? And so what's the prevailing wage rate, and what rate do you pay that comes up to half of that price?
If I may, Chair Witt, Representative Greenlick, what we're talking about is mostly electricians, some labor, some other trades, but mostly electricians. Prevailing wage for an electrician is about $35 an hour plus another $16 roughly in fringe. So it's about a $51, $52 an hour package. The standard non-union market rate for that sort of work, it ranges. It's not it's much more than half. But they might not spend quite as much on some of the fringe elements. So I don't know that you can take a direct result. This is what one company said was the difference for them, and it wasn't double. It was just 40% more.
If I could follow that, Mr. Chair.
Please do.
And but I think basically your testimony is that a job would be 40% more if prevailing wage is included, and I'd like to trail through that a bit because it frankly doesn't make sense to me.
But I'd be happy to walk through it. It's a little bit complicated. The model that I'm referring to is a power purchase agreement where the roof is made available as an example for lease, and it's not owned by the public entity. So the owner of that is an investor group, a power purchase agreement provider, and all they do is sell the energy to the building, and they sell it at a particular rate, and it's usually a 20-year period. They set the initial rate and an escalator every year that it goes up, and the building has to look at that and say, well, I currently pay PGE, for example, 7 cents per kilowatt hour, and if I wanted to buy the energy produced from the solar system on my roof, they're going to charge me whatever they're going to charge me. And in this particular example, it was 3 cents per kilowatt hour more if prevailing wage rates applied for the project.
4 cents as opposed to 7 cents.
It was 3 cents per kilowatt hour more. So if
as
they were paying,
I thought you said 4 cents and 7 cents were the two numbers I thought you used roughly.
So it'd be 7 cents is the current, or 10, which would be the new, in this particular example. So for example, if a company was paying, an agency was paying 7 cents per kilowatt hour to their current utility, and they were looking at putting allowing a third party to put solar on the roof, how much would that company charge them for the energy? It would be 3 cents per
kilowatt. Mr. Chair, one more, please. No, I understand the underlying basic principle. The question is, I thought the numbers you used was they bid 4 cents an hour without prevailing wage and 7 cents an hour with prevailing wage. Is that what your testimony? I thought that's what your testimony was, but
actually, this particular example had three options. One of them, it was 10.9 cents per kilowatt hour without prevailing wage, and 14.5 cents per kilowatt hour with.
Thank you.
And the third option was 4.9 without, 7.9 with. And the final option was 19.9 cents per kilowatt hour without prevailing wage and 22.9 cents per kilowatt hour with. So the average extra for prevailing wage was 3.2 cents per kilowatt hour more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, subcommittee members. I know there's a couple of you who've noted to me that you would like to ask questions, and unless it is not something that can wait until the end of the testimony, I'd like to afford Mr. Lane the opportunity to complete his testimony before we ask questions. Is there anyone who has that pressing question that can't wait? I appreciate that, subcommittee members. Please, Mr. Lane, continue.
Thank you. Actually, I'm basically done.
I'm going to ask if there is anyone in the audience who may have information regarding what percentage of the cost of generating a kilowatt of electricity may be due to labor costs, because that is something that would actually be helpful to me. That may be a question that's so esoteric that no one here has it. If you do, I'm going to ask you to step forward here in a little bit. With that, I think Representative Holvey was the first person who caught my eye.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, I guess I was just following up with Representative Greenlicks and really don't have a lot. It was sort of striking to me, though, that, of the comments that, essentially it appears to me that you're saying if we have to pay, the prevailing wage, that it's going to, cost this much more. And you don't consider the fringe part of that as part of the wage, when I think actually the definition of the wage includes the fringe in it. So I think that's sort of an inaccurate portrayal of what a wage is. You know, it's in, I think, the state's best interest that the people have health care and fringe benefits and retirement, because if they don't, it costs the taxpayer a lot more to provide that for them. And so it's, prevailing wage helps level the playing field to some degree, to make sure that when contractors are bidding projects, that they're on a level playing field, that some are providing benefits, that fringe package as such, and the ones who aren't are getting that fringe benefit basically subsidized by the taxpayer to some degree. Eventually, because that person has to go, someplace else, oftentimes to the public, to get their retirement or health care. So I think Representative Greenlick was sort of on target, because policy-wise, it seems to me we would want to have a pretty level playing field, so that contractors are competing on their ability to do the work and the quality of their work, and not who can pay the lowest wage and fringe benefit package. So I respect your concerns, but at the same time, I think it seems like paying less and less and less isn't exactly great for our economy either, to employees, because they use their money to buy houses and go to the store and shop and have their own ability to support and survive themselves. So I am a little bit troubled by that we would make a policy decision based on what I consider a race to the bottom by paying people less and less because it's cheaper on this specific project. And we have to look at the big picture. What's cheaper for the whole state if we have to, have a public subsidized health plan to take care of folks? So I'm a little concerned about that.
Please. Sure, Representative Holvey. I agreed. We don't want to have people living on the streets. We don't want to have to subsidize their health care. This is a narrow focus bill. Again, we're mostly talking electricians. To give an example, as I mentioned, $52 an hour for total package comes to about $104,000 total package annually if the electrician's working full time. A typical merit shop electrician, it's about $30 an hour. The benefit package, somewhere between 5 and 10. So we can average that out to, we'll call it 35. So that's $70,000 a year package. We're not talking about a group of people who is making below median income or that we're going to have to subsidize. Most of the people that would be doing a project of this caliber and this level are pretty well-paid folks regardless. And I agree, we don't want to race to the bottom. That doesn't help our industry, doesn't help me whatsoever. But I think that may be carrying this issue on a little broader than the electricians we're talking about.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're not talking, and I think you could probably do a better job of zeroing in on the wages, and we've kind of danced around it here. We're probably not talking $35 an hour prevailing wage for the electrician versus $12 an hour non-prevailing wage. I have a son that does different projects. Some are prevailing wage, some aren't, and I think the difference is more between... He's in Central Oregon, and I think the last example he gave me was $36 or $7 an hour for the work he does versus $20 to $25 an hour the rest of the time. The contractor he works for, though, his benefits don't change. So that's a little confusion I have. Maybe some contractors pay different benefits on prevailing wage jobs or whatever. One point I'd like to remind everybody of that we haven't really touched on here, because we've, you know, Representative Schaffler and I are in full agreement that we want to make sure that Oregonians make good family wage jobs with good benefits. Nobody's ever been able to define family wage. I remember during last session we asked that question, what is a family wage job, and it's kind of like squishy jello trying to nail that down. I think we all have a pretty decent idea, but the point I want to make is, so having said, I want to make sure that we do, particularly if public funds are being involved, we want to make sure that people make a good wage. The point that I'm making is that it is public funds being used, and who's going to pay the 7 cents a kilowatt hour or the 14 cent per kilowatt hour? It's the taxpayer in Oregon. So what we need to do here is find that balance, knowing that it's the taxpayer that's going to be paying the prevailing wage or the non-prevailing wage or the 7 cent per kilowatt hour or the 14 cent per kilowatt hour. I think my constituents are going to say, Huffman, I want you to go in there and find that balance. We want to pay people well, but at the same time, on a 20-year electrical contract, we don't want to be paying 40% more on our electricity, you know, for City of the Dalles to pay the electrical for the state office building there that they own.
Additional questions or comments?
I asked a question I kind of tossed out to the audience earlier, and it was probably more complicated, the manner in which I phrased it, than it had to be. Can you give us some kind of idea, when we're talking about solar-generated power, roughly what percentage of the cost of electricity would be allocated to the cost of construction or labor construction?
I would estimate about 20 to 25% of a solar PV project is labor in a non-prevailing wage project.
Okay. And so that roughly plus or minus other 80% would be principally divided among what categories?
The solar panels and inverters and
so the hardware in essence.
And permitting
and the permitting
and things like that.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Are there additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, yes, please.
Sorry, I forgot to mention one thing, that there's a complication with the Department of Energy, the Business Energy Tax Credit. For solar PV projects, there is an online calculator, a spreadsheet that says as the project gets to a certain size, here is the amount that's eligible for the Business Energy Tax Credit. And for large systems, it's a fairly aggressive target. It's a fairly low number or a low dollars per kilowatt. and the prevailing wage extra increase may put it over that cap and make a portion of the project not eligible for the tax credit. I don't think that's as applicable in smaller projects, but in larger ones, it may become more of an issue.
Okay. Vice Chair Huffman?
Just quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you define large project? I'm very familiar with wind, but in solar, what's a small and what's a large project? Are you referring to megawatts or the cost of the project?
Megawatts. So the Department of Energy has a program that defines the allowable dollars per watt for a project. It starts out in a small project, it's fairly high, and then there's a slope down, and then at 500 kilowatts, it flattens out. So anything 500 kilowatts and up is, I think, $5.84 a watt is what they say is allowable. Anything, if the project costs are more than that, then that excess amount isn't eligible for the tax credit.
Okay. Representative Woolley?
And just one more comment, I guess, just to, when we're speaking about the wages and the packages, and, you know, you would convert those into an annual figure of $100,000. I, you know, spend most of my life in the construction industry. I can tell you that I don't know many tradespeople that work 52 weeks out of the year. They have seasonal downtime. They have downtime between contracts, between projects. And if we want to keep a skilled workforce, you know, we're trying to make sure that they can survive for the whole year, so they're there for the next project next year. And so to categorically say these guys make $100,000 a year, I think is a little bit of a step out there that's not true for the bulk of the industry. And I know a lot of people that are out of work right now, and they're not collecting, they're collecting zero right now. So just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony.
You're welcome.
And with that, I have Ron Papsdorf, please, from the City of Gresham. And if there's anyone else that wishes to testify, if you'd please let us know by hand or whatever, that would be helpful.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, Ron Papsdorf, Government Relations Manager for the City of Gresham. Thanks for the chance to testify this morning on House Bill 3651. I did want to raise some concerns from our perspective on this bill. We do see it as an unnecessary expansion of prevailing wage law in this state, absent the broader conversation that I think Representative Holvey talked about is necessary, would certainly encourage and support and would be willing to participate in a much broader conversation about the whole of prevailing wage. And, you know, we've been tinkering with it now for many years, and maybe it's time to go back and have a more comprehensive look. I think in terms of these changes to existing law, though, I think it's important to point out that the standard for these solar installations does not relate at all to ownership of the facility, only the underlying building or land on which that facility lies, which is a pretty significant departure from, as Ms. Newhall stated, existing application of prevailing wage. Representative Esquivel's example was kind of interesting to me, but I would actually flip it on its head and give you the reverse. The way the language is written in the bill, if the City of Gresham leased a small amount of space for, say, a little local police precinct in an otherwise privately owned building on private land, and the owner of that private building wanted to install a solar installation on the rooftop of that privately owned building at their cost, then under this language, that installation would be subject to prevailing wage, because this language modifies the definition of owns of the land to include land, premises, structures, or buildings that employees of the public body use or occupy, or in which public business is conducted. I think for us, that's a concern specific to the bill, and would at the very least like to see that narrowed down a bit.
If this committee wants to focus on facilities that are put onto local land, or publicly owned land or publicly owned building, that's different than subjecting privately owned solar facilities that happen to be on a private building that a public agency might lease a small amount of space from. Finally, I guess a question for the committee is, why is this limited to solar? Why not a privately owned wind facility on public land? Again, this isn't limited to a publicly owned facility. It doesn't relate to whether the public agency who owns the land on which the facility is going does participate in a power purchase agreement to purchase the power from the installation or not. It could be an entirely private funded endeavor. They might have some power purchase agreement with another private entity somewhere else. They might be paying us a lease rate just to utilize available public land. And many public many power purchase agreements do have an option for ownership, but some don't. And under many PPAs, power purchase agreements, there is no requirement or expectation that facility will ever be owned by the people who agreed to purchase the power from that installation. So I appreciate the chance. I'd be happy to work with you on any adjustments to the bill that might be appropriate.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Pastor?
I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the public at this point that would like to testify on House Bill 3651? I'm not seeing anyone, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3651. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3652. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3652 requires the State Apprenticeship and Training Council to adopt rules that allow a local committee to determine circumstances in which an apprentice electrician who has completed either 6,000 or 6,500 hours of apprenticeship training, depending on the training requirements of their under the future license, can work without direct supervision during the remainder of their apprenticeship.
Thank you. And at this point, I'd like to call up Ryan Tribbett and John Killen, please.
Okay. For the record, Ryan Tribbett with the National Electrical Contractors Association. This bill is pretty simple. Thank you for taking it up. You guys had this bill in front of you last session. You passed it out of the sub. It died because it had lacked the fiscal paperwork needed at the Chamber of Origin deadline. We brought it back. We had a hearing on it last month, 3 weeks ago. There's no known opposition to it. As you'll see from what's being handed out right now, there's about seven organizations that support it. Every IBEW local in the state that has the limited energy licenses, training programs have all endorsed it. Independent contractors, union contractors, everybody's on board with this. Simply clarifies that when the limited energy license was created and went from an 8,000-hour license to a 6,000-hour license, that an apprentice can work for the last 6 months or so of their apprenticeship without supervision. It used to be at 6,500 hours when it was an 8,000-hour license. The 5,000-hour threshold for a 6,000-hour license would maintain that same consistency. Urge support.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm glad to be able to leave on a very positive note. This is a good fix for a minor mistake we made 3 or 4 years ago when we changed the licensing. I'm very pleased that we have an opportunity to make that clarification and that fix.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, are either of you aware of any opposition to this bill at this time?
No, sir.
Thank you. Subcommittee members, questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Certainly appreciate your time and support.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3652 and open a work session on House Bill 3652.
Mr. Chair, I do need to point out, and I apologize, I should have done this when doing the bill explanation. We do not have either the fiscal or revenue impact statements for this bill. So we could do a suspension of rules, however...
Do we need those to send it to the
Senate? We do, yes. The requirements from the regular session of having the fiscal and the revenue in front of the committee at the work session is required, again, during the special session.
But even in the subcommittee, sending it to the
committee? In theory, I guess you could, no, if you so choose, yes. You can pass to the full and do it that way. It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
They can't pass it out.
That is correct. Representative Greenlick, that is correct.
The sub can pass to the full committee, but the full committee can't pass to the floor without the fiscal.
Exactly.
Do we have any sense, Teresa, when that might be available?
I am not sure, but I can assure you that the original bill from the 2009 session, there was no fiscal and no revenue on that. So I would anticipate that would be the paperwork that would come forth to me.
I'm just thinking which way we whether we save any time or not. I mean, it's ready when it's ready, and so we probably don't save a whole lot of time by sending it on.
Mr. Chair, it's your prerogative to do that, and they can, be the work session for the sub can wait, or the full can wait until the paperwork is, in front of them.
All right. With that, we're closing the work session. Thank you all very much. for the good of the order. Teresa, we were discussing prior to our meeting here today some possible information meetings. Mm-hmm. Could you perhaps bring us up to date with some of the things that we're thinking about? And I know for certain that Representative Greenleg had some ideas. So
yes, Mr. Chair, I do know from discussions from our prior to our last, there has been some interest from some of the subcommittee members on looking at a couple of the transparency bills that were passed on the 2009 session, specifically House Bills 2500 and House Bill 2837, and just finding out what the status is of their implementation through probably Department of Administrative Services would come in for that presentation. There's also been discussion for the subcommittee to also look at in healthcare, continuing on with that, primarily the fact that that the health authority is now formulated and the workforce subcommittee within the healthcare authority has been created to see kind of where they're at in regards to their issues and their priorities. And
all right, and I know that there have been some reports, at least at the federal level, that have discussed workforce development and its potential contributions to restoring our national economy. And I think that some of the suggestions there in those reports may have relevance to what we could at least be considering here at the state level. So that's another idea. And Representative Greenleg, I know that you had some ideas about some things that we might want to entertain regarding development of the healthcare workforce.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think it would be useful, incidentally, to hear a report, although it may be a little early, from the Workforce Committee of the Oregon Health Authority, of the Oregon Health Policy Board. But I'd like us to take the opportunity, if we have a little time, to look to the future of the healthcare manpower situation. I've come to believe that we've reached a place where we have so siloed and created such specialization among health manpower that we can't possibly serve the needs of rural and other areas without creating new kinds of workers who are cross-trained and cross-licensed. I worry about, for example, in John Day, trying to have enough occupational therapists, physical therapists, sonographers, MRI techs, lab techs. And it seems to me the professions like to think that they're unique and special, but the fact is there's a ton of overlap among these fields. And if we could begin discussions about how to learn over sometime in the future how to cross-train these people and how to deal with getting them certified in ways that
that can make a lot more sense. We talk about people working at the top of their license, and everybody agrees to that, although we don't necessarily get there. But what we don't talk about people is talking at the bottom of somebody else's license. And it seems to me that's the kind of models we need to be thinking about. So if we could get some folks to help us think about that sometime now or in the interim, I know we have some time while we're here anyhow.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. I think I sense probably a healthcare segment with a number of potential ideas feeding into that. Perhaps kind of just workforce and economic development could be another one. I know, and possibly a component of that one maybe merits its own. The last meeting that we had, we heard testimony about the impacts that that child care or the lack thereof have on our workforce, and I certainly want to explore that further. Subcommittee members, if you have other ideas, this is an opportunity now to have some input as we're trying to develop our agenda. It's certainly not your last opportunity, but as things develop, if you would please make myself and Teresa aware of that, would be most appreciative as we go forward. Okay, anything else for the good of the order? Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Possible topic, not in the near term, but possibly out in a September meeting or something. The Green Jobs Council will have their complete study done, and it might be worth getting an update for the committee from them.
Thank you very much. Absolutely so. Thank you very much. Anything else? With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.